Welcome to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. I'm Sally Higginbottom and today I'm interviewing Dr. Steve Holmes, Education Lead for the Primary Care Respiratory Society, Respiratory Clinical Lead in Somerset and also a member of our CGP Council. We're discussing the recent module on COPD, which covers both a GOLD guidance and a Cochrane review of various treatment options. Hello, Steve.
Sally, how are you?
Okay. Tell me about COPD.
Great. I mean, COPD, obviously, to some of us with an interest, is a great passion and interest. But actually, to every practicing GP, we have a lot of our patients who come to see us with COPD or potential COPD for which we need to be thinking, has this patient got an underlying condition? A few quick facts. About 1.3 million people in the UK are currently diagnosed with COPD, and it's estimated through the British Lung Foundation and the Department of Health, that figure is probably somewhere near the 3 to 4 million mark. So there are a lot of people out there who are undiagnosed. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is a label that some of us used to remember as chronic obstructive airways disease.
And while we're on nomenclature, emphysema, is that the same thing or is that slightly different?
I guess what's happened over time is we've lumped emphysema, where we're looking primarily at breathlessness linked in with scarring of the tiny air sacs, the alveoli in the lungs, with chronic bronchitis, which is productive cough on many days of the month. And those were the old traditional two conditions that we thought of as chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, but have been moved together because of the synergies across that, and are probably part of a spectrum of other obstructive lung diseases like asthma. So there will be a spectrum where some people are primarily just breathless in the old emphysema type patient, who again nowadays on CT scanning we can see much more as the tiny scarring areas. Those who are primarily presenting with exacerbations of bronchitis, ongoing phlegm, discoloration, usually in association with breathlessness as well, and cough in association with that, and some people with an element of asthma in it.
Okay, that's very helpful. We always think about smoking with COPD, and I think that's right, but what else causes COPD?
Yes, Sally, really right to say smoking is by far the commonest cause, and if we're going to be diagnosing it without smoking, we should be really very careful. So an 80-year-old who seems to have COPD on spirometry but has never smoked, we should be very cautious about making the diagnosis there. Think, is the spirometry good enough quality? What else might it be? Traditionally, people have been talking about biomass fuel, so people who come from the third world who cook with organic materials in the house where there's not good ventilation, no chimneys and things, are inhaling smoke from a very young age, and a small number of those people do appear to go on to get a COPD-like condition. There are probably three other areas that are worthwhile thinking of. The first is a younger person who presents with significant COPD, who doesn't seem to have smoked for any length of time or a great deal. The key things I'd be thinking about then would be one, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, rare but important to think about. And the second thing along with that is somebody who has been smoking not traditional tobacco, but other substances you might get at music festivals or on the street in other ways. It appears that there seems to be impurities that hasten the speed of onset of COPD in that younger age group, linked in with potentially illegal substances being smoked.
Okay, that's very helpful. And when we're thinking about diagnosis, you mentioned spirometry. That's the gold standard diagnosis, is it still?
Well, spirometry helps us to confirm the diagnosis.
Okay.
So the gold standard diagnosis is a good history that fits in with the story. So they've smoked for a number of years, they've had a couple of episodes of bronchitis, they're getting more breathless when they walk about, more so than some of their other colleagues. So a good history, an examination that excludes other causes for breathlessness, like heart valve lesions, atrial fibrillation, other areas like that. So that's our two fundamental clinical parts to making the diagnosis. NICE guidance suggests we should also do a chest X-ray and a full blood count, again, to check out for unsuspected areas. And if those are fitting in with the story, we are looking for confirmation of our clinical diagnosis by spirometry.
That's really helpful. And when you were confronted with spirometry results, it's quite interesting in my work as an appraiser. It's very often on people's PDP to revise how to interpret spirometry. This comes up a lot. How do you approach it in simple terms?
Yes, I have the same dilemmas with ECGs. And first of all, I've got a good friend who will help me to interpret ECGs in my practice, who looks at an awful lot of them. So I ask a friend or phone a friend rather than always try and make the definitive diagnosis myself. I guess if you haven't got that asset in your practice for spirometry, like most things, it's really important just to check that the patient details are right and when the test was done. It's sensible to check their height and age, and often that is sensible because once in a while people put in 5'6" in the spirometer or onto the computer and it comes out as 5.6 meters rather than 5'6".
Okay.
Now you can imagine if someone's 5'6" tall, their lung function is going to be considerably bigger than if they're 1.7 meters.
Yes.
And therefore all the results will be higgledy-piggledy.
Yeah.
So do check the basics first. Also, you always look a bit silly if you're looking at a tracing that was done 3.5 years ago.
Yeah.
And you bring somebody in. The next part to that is, does the trace look a reasonable trace? So when we blow out quickly and we're trying to measure a forced expiratory volume, the volume at 1 second, and then the forced vital capacity, the total amount of air coming out, we're looking for a smooth line where the person will have expired and there'll be a 2 second or so straight line at the end showing that they've fully expired the air. If it goes up for 1.5 seconds and stops without that plateau, we're thinking they've probably stopped early.
Okay.
Other things to think through very quickly are, is there lots of squiggly lines on the spirometry? Are they coughing during it? Are there unusual steps in it? Do they start quite late? So you're looking at the trace to make sure that appears to be a good tracing. Cough is one of the common things with, you can imagine the line, if you're trying to breathe out and you suddenly cough, it becomes very irregular. Next stage, let's look at the parameters, and ideally we would like the effort put into each blow to be maximal. If it's variable effort, then the range of FEV1, FVC and the vital capacity will be quite varied. Shall I expand a little bit more on that?
Yeah.
If I'm a coal miner and it would be in my interest, because I smoked a bit but worked in the mines, to get a lot of money because of my COPD, and I know that I have to have a lower FEV1 than normal, then I might try to replicate that on a test.
Okay.
The problem is if I'm doing that maximally, that's really hard. You can't, you can try on a peak flow meter in the practice if you want, but try and blow a peak flow reading of, say, 220 reliably 3 times in a row. It's incredibly difficult if your peak flow is 600.
Yeah.
And so what we're looking for is maximal effort each time so that we can get a consistent reading. 100 mils is the normal accepted for that. That's the straightforward, now I can look at the test in earnest. And a clinical tip is, if there are squiggles or it doesn't look right, encourage your nurse or healthcare assistant who does the test to say why they think it wasn't such a good quality test. Coughing all the time, patient didn't appear to be able to breathe in, didn't understand the system, etc. The next thing is to look at the parameters that are being described, and that's our forced expiratory volume at 1 second, the amount of air we can blow out, really trying hard, the forced vital capacity and vital capacity, and the ratio of forced expiratory volume in 1 second to forced vital capacity, or vital capacity, whichever is the bigger. And the concept behind that is we're looking for a ratio of less than 70%. If there's less than 70%, we're thinking primarily about an obstructive cause, which might be asthma, it might be COPD, and that's why often we end up using a bronchodilator to see whether there is an improvement in their lung function.
And do we always need to do that? Do we need to do what we sometimes call reversibility testing, give them some salbutamol and try again?
I think it's very sensible to think it through, and if you've got a process, and in our practice we tend to do that as the general way of doing any spirometry. Let's think through. When I see a patient with very severe asthma, if I managed to get them to do spirometry and then gave them four puffs of salbutamol, I would expect some improvement after 15 minutes in their lung parameters. But I probably, if it was quite severe, I wouldn't expect it to go back to normal completely.
Yeah.
So tip number one is some improvement is suggesting it might be asthma. And the number we look for is 200 mils and 12%.
Okay.
The second part to that is if I see somebody with normal lung function who's an elite athlete and it's close to the borders in terms of their ratio, then actually when they're well, their peak flow, their FEV1, may be 20-30% above that of a normal person, which is why they're good at athletics or why they're good at sport, because their lung capacity is good and they can keep going longer than most of us. So by and large, yes, it is sensible to look at reversibility testing as part of that process. If you have somebody with asthma and they have their spirometry done, then number one, if they are well controlled and treated with their inhaled corticosteroid, the pre-bronchodilator test will be normal and the post-bronchodilator test will remain normal because they are well controlled. So don't be tricked into thinking that completely normal spirometry will exclude a diagnosis of asthma.
Because asthma can be episodic, and because if it's well controlled, you should be symptom free.
Yes, so asthma is a variable condition, and with treatment we should be able to control it.
Okay, that's really helpful. So those of us who work in areas which have cough know that we have to recheck the FEV1 annually of all of our patients with COPD, and this is one of my personal bugbears because now we don't base treatment on that. So why are we doing it?
Right. I think probably the thing is most of the evidence when cough was developed and from NICE is based on a vast amount of literature in the world, and there are two common things that people talk about. BODE, which is a hospital-based assessment, that is body mass index, obstruction, which is our FEV1, dyspnea, which is an MRC type score, and E, which is exercise, a 6-minute shuttle walk test. In general practice, Rupert Jones from Exeter and colleagues from around the world validated a much more straightforward thing for us as GPs to use, which is, the acronym is DOSE, D-O-S-E, published very widely. D is dyspnea, that's our MRC score, which we use for cough. O is obstruction. S is smoking status. And E is exacerbation rate. And those are the two main things that tell us how good somebody is going to do in the long run. Think about our patient who is very breathless, has a low FEV1, is still smoking and exacerbates a lot. They tend to do much less well than the people who have the converse of that, who stop smoking, don't exacerbate, have relatively good FEV1 and symptomatically doing well. The FEV1 perhaps hasn't lost its place completely, although GOLD in its most recent iteration has suggested to try and keep it a little bit easier, I think, to say, why don't we just concentrate on two things, exacerbation rate and symptoms.
Yeah.
I wish they'd left smoking in there because, again, fundamentally, a lot of patients throughout the world with COPD continue to smoke. And that isn't really emphasised enough in GOLD. But remember, GOLD's a strategy, not a guideline. They choose the literature they want to make the points they want.
Okay. And I was taught that the treatment for COPD is smoking cessation, smoking cessation, smoking cessation. I'm guessing that hasn't changed.
It has a little bit. I was going to say that that might show your age, because probably the evidence against that went out about 20 years ago. But unfortunately, it is something I still hear. If we look at the Cochrane reviews, smoking cessation is obviously vital. There is good evidence that pulmonary rehabilitation increases your quality of life, reduces your exacerbation rate, and if it's provided early, reduces your mortality rate. These are all Cochrane reviews. The same is true of LAMAs on their own, so long-acting muscarinic antagonists, the commonest and oldest example being tiotropium. LAMAs and LABAs, that is some of the newer four combinations that are available on the market at the moment. A LABA and an ICS, and the commonest one of those that we used to use would have been seretide licensed doses, all have good evidence, as does treating exacerbations appropriately with steroids and antibiotics, and as does the concept, although perhaps not as enthusiastically in the Cochrane reviews, of use of flu and pneumococcal vaccination. So the treatment of COPD is not only smoking cessation, but is therapeutic, is around pulmonary rehabilitation, structured convincing exercise, is about prevention with pneumococcal and influenza vaccination, and is about appropriate treatment of acute flare-ups.
Okay, so that brings us to the Cochrane review that this module covers, which looked at the comparison between LAMA and LABA with LABA and inhaled steroids. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
So what did they find and what's your view on it?
Right. Again, this is a Cochrane review, so you have to work out exactly how they do the review and what it's designed to show. And what it managed to find was 12 reasonably good trials that followed specific methodologies comparing LAMA and LABA inhalers, and there were a mix of those in the mix, compared to, and actually they all compared it to Seretide 500 micrograms twice daily. There was no other option, so they compared it to what in the UK for the last several years has been considered to be a very high dose inhaled corticosteroid and the highest licensed dose for COPD, most people using half or less of that steroid load in their treatments. So you've got to bear it in mind that they were comparing this against a very high dose inhaled corticosteroid. Remember, when you set off on a trial, it's often several years before the results come out. So that was part of what was practiced at the time. I think the other thing that's worthwhile noting in most of the trials where it's easy to get hold of the methods, most of these, what they did was they had people on whatever their current treatment was, which would usually be a triple inhaler, a triple inhalation medication of a LAMA, LABA and ICS. So all three together. Yeah. And what they did was they converted these people on during the run-in period to a LAMA alone. And it was not unsurprising that 20% or so, sometimes higher, sometimes a little bit less, of patients dropped out before they were actually randomised into the trial, and left us with a group of people that appeared to be stable in that run-in period on just a LAMA and didn't need to have the LABA ICS. Then comparing a LAMA versus a LABA ICS, you would expect the people that responded well to the LAMA to continue to respond well to the LAMA, and perhaps a more variable response to the people who weren't on the LABA ICS and had been excluded earlier. I hope that sort of makes sense.
That does. So it may be that we shouldn't be too hasty to move all of our patients from their LABA ICS to a LABA LAMA combination. Is that right?
That's right. I think what we should be doing is, certainly I think there's a good move to be saying, think about our patients in terms of their exacerbation rate, and think of our patients in terms of their symptoms. If they have symptoms, part of our job is to encourage them to exercise and do lots, and the other part is, as far as we can, to help them to, if you like, maximally bronchodilate and enable them to do as much as they can. And the more they can do, the more they're able to do, because they can exercise more and that cycle continues, and that's a positive way forward. I think when it comes to exacerbations, again, there's evidence for LAMA and LAMA-LABA combinations of reduction in exacerbation rate. I think if symptoms are still going on, then I would have a relatively low threshold for using one of the ICS add-ins, but at a lower dose than perhaps we used 10 years ago.
And that's because there is a risk with the higher dose steroids of, higher risk with the higher dose steroids of pneumonias. That's our concern, isn't it?
Yes, with the use of an inhaled corticosteroid at high dose is equivalent to using an oral steroid. And although the different types of inhaled corticosteroid have often been debated. Budesonide, beclometasone, fluticasone propionate, fluticasone furoate is one more likely to cause problems than others. Again, the Cochrane Review has suggested the impact of each of those is similar, but the higher the dose, the more side effects. Okay. That's not unsurprising. We know that from our oral steroids as well. And remember, it's not just about pneumonia. It's about diabetes, senile purpura, cataracts, and all the other attributes we have with very high dose inhaled corticosteroids.
Okay.
Perhaps on the converse of that, just think if you have a patient who has asthma and then has gone on to have fixed airways disease or more fixed airways disease, and that's the sort of person who should remain on an inhaled corticosteroid. So someone with definite asthma who is less reversible now, it is probably still sensible to make sure they stay on their ICS long term.
Okay. So thinking about the inhalers, I found the Right Breathe website really helpful for information about inhalers. Is there any information you find particularly useful?
At the moment, I'd probably go for the Right Breathe site as well. It's a good, freely accessible resource. You can get an app with it on. You can use it from your computer. It has good quality general practice input from Azhar Salim, who's a general practitioner colleague from London. And it shows each of the inhaler devices, how to use them, and the licensed doses. I think there's probably something on cost there, but I can't remember that for sure.
Okay.
But I know people would be interested in the cost, so I suspect it's in there.
Yeah, domiciliary oxygen always causes a degree of controversy. Who benefits from it?
Perhaps it's easier to say, first of all, people who might not benefit are those who continue to smoke, because there's an increasing number of severe burns and even house fires and death that have occurred because of people using oxygen and smoking in the same environment.
Okay.
Who would benefit? The people who are going to benefit most are those with relatively severe COPD, where their oxygen saturations as measured by pulse oximetry is 92% or less on two occasions when they're stable. And what we should be doing with those is refer to the oxygen assessment team, a specialist service, which will do further bloods to just make sure that is the right way forward, and then we'll arrange for implementation and onward review of the oxygen. I must confess, I don't prescribe oxygen myself. I would always refer, because the prescriber retains the responsibility. And what I want to happen is to make sure that when a patient is given oxygen, they get the right amount in the right situation. For long-term oxygen, domiciliary oxygen, you're looking at the patient ideally using that for 15 hours every day. Okay. And also having the ability to have some small portable oxygen to take if they go outside, if that symptomatically helps them.
The module has a great pyramid showing the relative value of various treatment options. It's hard to explain on audio, but what are your thoughts about where we should concentrate our efforts in terms of COPD management?
Yes, the pyramid looks great, and I think has a really good hit rating in terms of it tells us what is the most effective intervention we can make for someone with COPD. It was developed around 2012 by a national collaboration between the British Thoracic Society and the Primary Care Respiratory Society, had GP specialist involvement, used a lot of the financial analyses in previous literature reviews to say, if I had to give a treatment, what would be the most cost-effective treatment that would improve the quality of life for someone with COPD? And the most cost-effective intervention in the reviews was flu immunisation at about £1,000 per quality. Remember, NICE says that anything under about, I think it's about £28,000 per quality, is good value. So NICE would be suggesting lots of interventions under £28,000 a quality is something we should be doing in all sorts of walks. £1,000 is phenomenally effective. The second thing on that list was smoking cessation. And the third thing on the list was pulmonary rehabilitation, smoking cessation being about £2,000 and pulmonary rehab costing between £2,000 and £8,000. Following that, there are medications, and at the time of the review, that was the LAMA and the LABA and triple therapy put into combination. And all of those would be approved by NICE, but let's make sure we get the basics right first. The final thing that I think is in the new pyramid that you're looking at is telehealth, which unfortunately is even more costly than some of the other interventions and probably wouldn't be approved by NICE if it was reviewed by them.
What's the most interesting area in COPD management for you at the moment?
I guess for me, the most interest is getting back to our patients again. People with COPD can feel a little bit discriminated against in comparison with other groups, but good positive treatment for them, encouragement for them to take more exercise and help them to support and stop smoking can make a huge difference. I think the other challenges which make it interesting are that a lot of people with COPD have other comorbidities that can make it harder for us to manage. The commonest cause of death from COPD is actually heart disease, but not all of us are checking for that on a regular basis in our clinics. So the interesting areas are about really developing that holistic, good quality general practice approach. And I guess the other part is, how do we motivate people who don't feel as though it's worthwhile being motivated anymore?
That seems like a good question on which to leave it. Thank you very much. And thank you for listening to this podcast from the RCGP.